Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, the author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. Matthew Desmond is our important guest this hour. The city he profiles is the one we're sitting in right now, Milwaukee, where he spent 2 years living in a Southside trailer park and later a rooming house on the north side of Milwaukee. He focuses on the private rental market where the vast majority of poor people live. He spent time with tenants and with landlords. All too often the tenants are evicted. Wait till you hear the numbers. They're incredible. The private rental market, he says, plays an imposing and vital role in the lives of the families he knew in Milwaukee, consuming most of their income, aggravating their poverty and deprivation, resulting in their eviction, insecurity, and homelessness, dictating where they lived and whom they lived with, and powerfully influencing the character and stability of their neighborhoods. And until this book, we hardly knew a thing about it. The book is about Sharina and Tobin, Arlene and Jory, Lorraine and Scott and Pam, Crystal and Vanetta and others. And Matthew wants us to talk about them and remember the fact that somewhere in your city, a family has just been evicted from their home, their things piled high on the sidewalk. He is, Matthew, a professor of social sciences at Harvard University and coordinator of the Justice and Poverty Project. He was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant in 2015. He started his work on this really in 2008 when he was a student at UW-Madison, and the book has been receiving a lot of attention and very deservedly so. Matthew, thank you very, very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Yeah. Great to be here.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. I know the places of which you write, and you've just done this incredible thing. It's just amazing. You've looked at something that's so vital and so overlooked, but you've done it with such incredible compassion and beautiful description. These people just kind of haunt me now. They really do. I feel like I know them. It's quite something. So let's start with, and you said at one point in the book that you really, when we talk about it, you want to talk about some of these people. So pick who you want, and I do want to talk about Sharina and Tobin, but pick whoever you want to start with, Lorraine or Scott or Pam or Crystal or Vanetta or Arlene, and give a face to a story here. Maybe Arlene is the place to start.
That sounds great. So when I first met Arlene, she was living on 13th and Keefe, which is one of the poorest neighborhoods in Milwaukee. And she's renting a two-bedroom unit to house herself and two boys that she was trying to raise. That apartment, which was pretty shabby in a low-income neighborhood, took 88% of her income, which at that time was welfare. And so she was put in these really terrible situations, terrible choices. You know, can I give my kids all that they need to eat this month, or should I pay the rent? Should I pay for a funeral cost, or should I pay the rent? And, you know, under those conditions, under the massive amount of money that she was dedicating just for a roof over her head, you know, eviction was something that was easy to invite. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't take a major setback or a moment of vast irresponsibility. It was more inevitable under those conditions.
Mm-hmm. And the circumstances of eviction, you write about this, that we normally don't think about. Her son had been throwing snowballs, I guess, at somebody in the street, and the guy got mad and came in the house and banged down and broke the door, and all of a sudden, the police come, and all of a sudden, we don't want the police in our place because the place may not be up to code. You're out.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I learned from doing this research was just how tenuous of a grasp a lot of poor families have on their housing. And something as little as a snowball, as innocent as a snowball, can tip you into eviction. So this is a story that the book opens with, where Jory, Jory's 14. He's Arlene's son. He's being a 14-year-old. You know, he's tossing snowballs at cars. He hits one hard. Man jumps out. He runs into Arlene's house, and the man kicks the door down. And luckily, he left before anything else happened. But that's property damage, and when the landlord found out about it, she moved forward with an eviction, and so kids often can provoke eviction. They often can do things that annoy a landlord or receive extra attention from people like the police or EPA inspectors if they test positive for lead poisoning or child protective services. So kids don't shield families from eviction. They often expose them to it.
Mm-hmm. The problem, a huge problem, we don't think of it this way for black women particularly, is eviction. For black men, it's incarceration.
So the face of our eviction epidemic, not only in Milwaukee but across the nation, is mothers with children. And if anyone has ever been in room 400 in the Milwaukee County Courthouse, you can see just kids running around, kids sleeping, you know, kids of all ages in there. Most households evicted in Milwaukee have children living in them. And you're right, it disproportionately affects low-income African-American communities. Among renters in Milwaukee, one in five African-American women report being evicted sometime in their life, compared to one in 15 white women. So it's absolutely true that it's disproportionately affecting low-income, especially African-American moms, and they're the ones bearing the brunt of the consequences of forced displacement.
The other story that really haunts me is Lamar's story because of what happened to him, but also that he's trying to be a voice of some kind of wisdom for all of the young African-American males who live in the neighborhood who come to him really for security and for some kind of advice. And his story just makes you cry.
I feel that all the people in this book have different, they're complex, right? Landlords and tenants, you know, and Lamar is certainly one of them. And so Lamar was a single dad who was living in the inner city. And he was, he's a wheelchair bound, he's a double amputee, and was trying to raise these two teenage boys. And he was a stabilizing presence in the neighborhood. You know, he, his house was the place where all the boys ended up, you know, late at night, playing cards and joking off. And you know, he served as somewhat of a role model. But he, too, was spending over 70% of his income on housing and eventually fell on hard times and tried to work off the rent with Sharina, his landlord, tried to paint one of her units to try to earn back the debt. It didn't work out for him.
Let's talk about Sharina, because she's a fascinating person as well. Used to be an elementary school teacher in Milwaukee and has become an incredibly successful landlord with all kinds of properties, for which she gets a pretty penny, I might add. These aren't places that are $200, $300, $300 a month.
That's right. So Sharina, when I met her, she owned 36 units, all on the north side of Milwaukee. And she kind of thought of herself as a charitable businesswoman. She was very proud of her business. She was proud of what she had built. She, too, is complex, you know. So I've seen her buy tenants groceries when they didn't have enough food. And I've seen her evict a tenant for calling the building inspector on her. I think that the part about the pretty penny is an important one. And when I started this work, I wondered why landlords would buy and run property in some of the poorest neighborhoods in the city. And when I left, I wondered why they wouldn't. Mm-hmm. You know, the profit margins are pretty substantial. So Sharina would make, in an average month, what many of her tenants took home the whole year. And she did this, she did this not in spite of the poverty in these neighborhoods, but often because of it. You know, she could buy properties on the cheap. She could rent them lower, but not that much lower than other properties, and she was able to make a fairly substantial living.
So how often did it happen, Matthew, that she would give somebody a little bit more time on rent that was back due because then they wouldn't complain about the walls or windows having holes in them or mold growing in the walls, et cetera?
So this is an important point. This is about why people are living in substandard housing. You know, we have laws to protect tenants from these kind of things. But what I found when I was doing this work for evicted is that those laws don't stretch to the very bottom of the rental market. And let me just explain why. So if you're someone like Arlene that's paying 88% of your income to rent, you can't pay first month's rent, last month's rent, and security deposit. So you kind of start off day one behind. Mm-hmm. And what Sharina would do is, in her words, you know, you give me a break, I'll give you a break. And so what that meant is Sharina would allow someone like Arlene to move into a property that had problems. And Sharina would kind of allow the tenant to get fully caught up. But for that exchange, she could kind of pass on some housing maintenance. She might not fix the plumbing, for example, like she did with another tenant, or the windows might have holes in them. That was Arlene's case. And tenants are really afraid to call the building inspector and report those issues. Not because they don't know that number or because they don't know the rights. They absolutely do. It's because they know that those rights literally cost money, and they could be evicted if they make the call. Not because retaliatory evictions are legal, but because they're behind, you know, on, with their landlord. Mm-hmm. And so if you're in a situation where you're going to have to ask your landlord's compassion, you know, you're going to miss rent, you know, 1 month, it's really risky to take advantage of your rights.
So let's look at both the Southside Trailer Park and the Northside properties. At what point is there compassion? At what point has a line been crossed and you have to be pretty tough about eviction? Or does it all ultimately end in eviction and it's just a matter of buying yourself a little bit of time? But what makes the landlord cross over and say, I'm sorry, maybe they don't even say I'm sorry, you're gone?
Oh, so many things, you know, and I think that you're right that landlords often do let tenants pass a bit. You know, I looked at the rent rolls for Tobin, who is the landlord that I rented from in the trailer park where I lived. And, you know, on any given month, a third of the trailer park was behind.
Mm.
You know, and he was not evicting a third of the trailer park in any given month. So there is a lot of discretion and a lot of things that come in to color that discretion, to kind of inform the eviction decision, don't have to do with bottom line arithmetic. So one of the big things is kids, again, going back to kids. So one thing that I did for this work was interview about 250 tenants right after their eviction court in Milwaukee. I wanted to know, what explains why, if you and I both go to court, Kathleen, why do you get evicted and I don't?
Mm-hmm.
And what we found is that you can control for things like your household income, race, and gender. You can control for how much you owe a landlord. And what really matters when it comes to deciding who gets that eviction judgment is kids. Do you live with kids? If you live with kids, it almost triples the odds that you're going to receive an eviction judgment. So, and what you're seeing there is landlord discretion.
Mm. And all of these people, you did an incredible amount of research, and so did students from UW-Madison, that I was amazed that so many tenants, 250 of those tenants, you interviewed them, and 84% answered you this very lengthy questionnaire. People are concerned about it.
Oh, yeah, we did a lot, you know, because I was spending time on the ground with landlords and tenants, and I needed basic answers to questions. You know, how often does eviction happen? Who gets evicted? What are the consequences? You know, so I went out and looking for studies that would allow me to answer those questions, but I didn't find much. And I didn't find enough data that would really get to the bottom of it. So I decided I needed to collect it myself, and so I analyzed hundreds of thousands of eviction records. We ended up interviewing over 1,000 renters in the city of Milwaukee, and you're right, we had a really high response rate, which gives us really good data. And we interviewed 250 people in eviction court, we analyzed millions of 911 records, and we put all that data together in concert, you know, with the stories that I was learning on the ground, and I think all those methods informed one another and kept them honest. The book really starts at the ground level and ends at the ground level. You know, it kind of prioritizes people's stories and their narratives, because that's where I learn the most, and I think that's where I think readers can learn the most. But you're absolutely right, it does tack up and draws on the statistical data to answer very basic questions about the role that housing is playing in deepening poverty in the American city.
What are the consequences of eviction, Matthew?
How much time do we have?
We have a while.
Yeah.
But people need to read your book. People really need to read your book. But just,
yeah.
Yeah,
so you know, people don't just lose their homes when they're evicted. They often lose their possessions that are either, you know, piled on the sidewalk or taken by movers, and you have to keep up payments to get your stuff back, and some people just can't.
Right.
So the biggest moving company in Milwaukee that does eviction moves told me that about 70% of their moves that are evictions or foreclosures just end up in the dump. You lose your community. Children lose their schools.
Mm-hmm.
Eviction, when it goes to the court, comes with a court record. And we know that a criminal record can have an effect on your life. You know, it can prevent you from receiving government aid, and it can be hard on the job market when you have a criminal record. Well, eviction record functions the same way. It can affect your credit. It can bar you from receiving public housing because housing authorities count evictions as strikes against your record. And in a situation where most low-income families don't receive any kind of public housing or housing assistance, you know, we're kind of systematically denying that little aid we already have to the people arguably that need it the most, the evicted. That eviction record, a lot of landlords won't take you, you know, if you have an eviction within the last 2 or 3 years. So evicted families move into worse housing into worse neighborhoods. We have good evidence that eviction causes job loss, not necessarily the other way around. Of course, when you lose your job, you can invite eviction, but we have stronger evidence that actually it's the other way. You get evicted and you lose your job. And any listeners out there that have been through that process know why. It's a consuming, stressful, overwhelming event, mm-hmm. and it can cause you to make mistakes at your work and eventually maybe get fired.
Yeah.
And then you have to think about health and the effect that eviction has on your spirit, your mental health. We know that moms that get evicted have higher rates of depressive symptoms 2 years later. We know that suicides attributed to evictions or foreclosure doubled between 2005 and 2010, years that housing costs were soaring. So you add all that up. You know, you take a step back and you take all that into account. And I think we have to conclude that eviction is a cause, not just a condition of poverty. It's really making things worse out there.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it causes, there's so many layers to this story. The other story, weaving another person into this, is Crystal. Mm. And people who, because of their circumstances, have to take whatever it is they can get. And it might be a roommate or an offer to stay someplace from somebody you know virtually nothing about. You don't know them. You're passing shoulders with them, you know, on the street or at an office somewhere. And all of a sudden, because you've been evicted, you have to depend on the kindness, and it may not always be kindness, of a virtual stranger it helps save costs. You will live together, right?
That's right. You know, sociologists have long thought that, you know, poor folks make ends meet by relying on kin, their family, on a day-to-day basis. And I saw that, too. You know, I saw people asking their aunties and their grandmas and their sisters for help. But I saw something else that was a bit troubling. It should trouble us about the strength of the family safety net in our poor communities. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, a lot of the evicted folks end up kind of teaming up with virtual strangers, acquaintances. We call them disposable ties, people that they don't know very well, but they kind of cast their lot in with. And they meet at, you know, eviction court, at homeless shelters, on the street, at a bus stop. And Crystal was one of them. You know, when Arlene was evicted, you know, Crystal was the prospective new tenant that Sharina showed into her home. And, you know, after Crystal agreed to take the apartment, she turned to Arlene and said, you know, what are you going to do? And when Arlene said, I don't know, you know, she offered a place. She said, well, you can stay here until you find another place. And Arlene just took it. She took the opportunity, you know, because it was homelessness or that.
Right.
And that's tough. And, you know, the parents out there, just think about that. You know, I have young kids. Just think if we were put in a situation where, you know, we thought the best thing to do for our kids was to live with a stranger. You know, that's kind of the situation that moms like Arlene are facing today. And oftentimes those you know, relationships formed under such duress and pressure fizzle out, and sometimes they explode. And I think they would for any of us, not only because of the stress we're dealing with, but because we are, you know, putting so much strain on a relationship with someone that we don't know very well.
Yeah. I know you carry these people with you as well, that you've kept in touch with them, you've helped mm-hmm. some of them. Some of them were just really, really, probably many of them, really kind to you, getting you a birthday cake on your birthday, sending money to your son. Obviously, people who have nothing who are giving you what they had.
Yeah, that left a really deep mark on me.
Mm.
And, you know, when I started this work, I thought, well, how do I get in? You know, how do I get in? That's going to be the hardest thing. Gosh, that wasn't the hardest thing. You know, the hardest thing was leaving. You know, it was leaving the city that I loved and leaving these people that have taught me so much. And, you know, I saw a lot of suffering and I saw a lot of pain, but I saw so much courage and strength and intelligence and beauty in the face of adversity. I remember one time Crystal was with a woman named Vanetta, and they were both homeless, and they were at McDonald's eating lunch, and this young boy walks in, and he was maybe 8 or 9, and he had dirty clothes on, and instead of going up to order, he just went around to the tables. He was looking for scraps. Mm. He was looking for something to eat. And Crystal turned to Vanetta and said, you know, what you got? And they pulled their money, and they bought this boy lunch, and Crystal gave him this hug and sent him on his way, and turned to Vanetta and said, you know, I wish I had me a home, I would take him in.
Hmm.
And those stories fill that book, too,
mm-hmm.
because they're crucial for me, and they showed me how gracefully and powerfully people like Vanetta and Crystal refused to be reduced to their hardship and how we as a nation, in our tolerance for this cold denial of basic needs, this massive suffering, are reducing people born for better things.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Matthew Desmond, his book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. And the city that he chose to write about and to live in a dilapidated trailer park on the south side of Milwaukee and a rooming house on the north side of Milwaukee. He got to know these people who lived in the area. He follows a number of people pretty closely, tenants and also landlords. Their story is also fascinating and looks at the layers of complexity. And it's a very, very important book. It's been receiving lots and lots of attention, and we hope that it will at the highest level of government so that people will no longer overlook this private rental market, which is where most poor people get their place to live, and how incredibly hard it is and how often they're evicted and what that leads to. And a big question is why it is that we haven't focused on this. And do we need to? Obviously we do. Our phone number, and we have a lot of messages coming in, and we welcome your phone calls as well. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them. Our lines are filled, but just keep trying. You'll get through eventually. Matthew Desmond is our guest. The book is Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Because I haven't read this book yet, but I'm familiar with it from a review in the New York Review of Books written by Jason DeParle, I've been paying quite a bit of attention to Syrian and other refugees in foreign countries. And DeParle ends the review. I know authors and reviewers sometimes differ, but he focuses on the story of Arlene and Jory and the kitten and the mannequin. I was wondering if the author would be willing to either read that or talk about it, because it's absolutely Dickensian.
Thanks, Rich. I actually don't have a copy of my book in front of me.
Oh, no.
But you know, this is a story of loss, you know, and this is a story of these things that are harder to quantify and articulate, you know. And Jory, who was 14, left when they were evicted from their apartment on 13th and Keith. They had a cat. They had this cat named Little. And they had to leave the cat behind with an upstairs neighbor who was struggling with addiction, but she was the one that could take the cat. And, you know, they bounced around, and they went from homeless shelter to other unsustainable places, and through a twist and turn of events, eventually found themselves actually back with that neighbor, the upstairs neighbor, who was supposed to watch their cat, Little. And she had let the cat out, and the cat had died. And it affected Jory in this deep way, and he expressed it by kind of finding this mannequin head in her apartment and just punching it over and over mm-hmm. again. And it was heartbreaking to me to see that, heartbreaking to his mom, Arlene, to see that too. And I think it reflects how much, you know, a home is much more than shelter. You know, it's much more than four walls and a roof. You know, a home is the center of life. And without it, you know, so much more falls apart.
Mm-hmm. And you write so beautifully about, again, going back to Lamar for a moment, who moved into a place that, you know, it was disgusting to read about it. It was so horrible. But he just tidied the place up and took great pride in these meager surroundings, almost to the point of being obsessive compulsive about it. Right, Matthew?
I think that's pretty accurate. I mean, his cupboard was military grade, and you know he kept an extremely spick and span home, and would do things whatever he could to fix it up, you know, for his boys. It was a small two bedroom place. He gave each of his boys their own bedroom, and he slept in the living room. He thought that was a way to honor them, be a good dad.
Mm-hmm.
He found some tile, you know, lying around, and retiled his own bathroom, I think using toothpaste to put the tile down. So he invested in his home as much as he could. It was just extremely hard for him to hold on to it, giving almost everything he had to rent.
Let's go. Thanks, Rich, for your call. Jeff in Mayville. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Jeff. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. I'm just a fairly recent listener. I just started listening a year or two ago, and I do love the show. I just wanted to relate a story. It was about 4 years ago. We were living in Iron Ridge, my wife and I and my two sons, and my wife ended up becoming very ill. She was basically on her deathbed, you know, in the hospital. She spent 2 months in University Hospital in Madison and then a month in a hospital in Pewaukee. And the person we were renting from, we lived in Iron Ridge at the time, and she lives very well. I mean, she's very well off. She's got a very nice house. And when my wife got out of the hospital, she said, well, we need some repairs done. And she called, you know, the landlord, and all of a sudden there was eviction. She started eviction, you know, on us. And I don't know how it happened, but we, at that November, I went to pay the rent, you know, on the first, and she was all smiles. She took to the rent, never said anything. She says, how are things going? How's your wife and stuff? And I said, well, she's all right, thank you. And I thought, okay, you know, the eviction's, you know, she, you know, I had met her husband a week before, and he said everything was fine. So come the week of Christmas that year, all of a sudden there was a knock on the door, and it was the Dodge County Sheriff's Department said, handing us an eviction notice. He said, you have 5 days to vacate the premises. And I says, what do you mean? And he says, well, your landlord's evicting you. And we had all we could do to get just our beds and, you know, our furniture out. All our baby memories were left there, and file cabinets with taxes and everything else was left in there. And within a couple weeks after we were, they locked the doors on us, we were still talking to the neighbors on the other side of the duplex, and they said, oh, yeah, she came in with a bunch of dump trucks and just basically emptied out the house and took it right to a landfill. Never gave us a chance to get her stuff back or, you know, or stored or anything, you know, like they were supposed to have done. And I don't know, I just feel very cold-hearted on her part, you know, to do that to somebody. I mean, we weren't behind on rent or anything. It's just because we were, you know, wanted some repairs done, and she just decided to evict us. So, I mean, it does not only Milwaukee. I mean, it happens everywhere.
Right.
You
know? Yeah. Matthew.
Yeah, Jeff, thanks so much for sharing. And I'm really sorry, not only about your wife's illness, but you had to go through the loss of your home and lose those possessions. Thanks for your courage of sharing that. You're absolutely right that this is a widespread problem. This isn't just in Milwaukee or in San Francisco or in New York. You know, this is a nationwide problem. Over 2 million Americans every year report, you know, that they think there will be evicted soon, you know, within the next couple months. About 1 in 5 renters all over America are paying at least 50% of their income on housing. So you're absolutely right that this is something that's affecting communities all across the nation. I think it's important for the listeners to know, too, that, you know, when someone like Jeff is confronted with an eviction notice, if you can't afford a lawyer, you are not provided one. Unlike in criminal court, where low-income families have access to legal counsel, public defenders, it's not the case in civil court, where evictions and foreclosures are processed. So in many housing courts around the country, 90% of landlords have attorneys, and 90% of tenants don't. So even someone like Jeff, who was in a situation of real kind of legal limbo, so to speak, or, you know, where a landlord may have been violating his rights, it's not clear that he could have just gotten a lawyer and fought it. It's we have a massive lack not only of lawyers, but of rights to lawyers in eviction court.
Hmm. So he didn't have, say, a public defender available to him that's not widely accessible?
No. No, absolutely not. And so, you know, most people in Milwaukee that are summoned to eviction court don't show up. And you and I probably wouldn't show up either if we were someone like Arlene that has an 11th grade education and has to go face-to-face either with her landlord that's in eviction court almost every week or the landlord's attorney. And so most just don't make their case. That's why one of the conclusions that the book makes is a renewed call for legal services in housing court. We could do a lot to stem the fallout from eviction, to stop the cost that we incur downstream with this problem by investing money smartly upstream and making sure people don't experience illegal evictions and have their case heard in court, unlike the vast majority of eviction cases today.
Hmm. Here's an email that's come in from Jenny. It's on Facebook, actually. You might be familiar with this in Wisconsin. I must say that I wasn't, but we should do a show on this. There's a bill now in the Wisconsin legislature that would allow landlords to evict a tenant if that person, a member of the tenant's household, a guest, or any other person invited to their home engages in any criminal activity, regardless of whether anyone was arrested or convicted. Tenants would get 5 days to vacate the premises. Tenants who are the victims of the criminal activity could not be evicted.
Yeah, I don't think that's in process anymore. I think that has passed. I think that's a new law.
Oh, it is.
In Wisconsin. Yeah, absolutely. I think that passed within last week. My question about that law is, do we have due process? Are tenants able to go through a system of checks and balances where they get to hear their side of the story or not? And my question is, what good is this serving or what good is it doing? The landlord, there have been certain laws that have held landlords accountable for their tenants' behavior, things like nuisance ordinances. We did a big analysis of these in Milwaukee and showed that they have really unanticipated consequences on some very vulnerable groups, including domestic violence survivors, who, because they call 911, are subjected to evictions. And so I think that if this new law results in something like that, we need to take a really hard look at it, and we need to make sure that we are providing due process and that it doesn't have unanticipated consequences on people that are trying to access the law.
Thanks very much for your call, Jeff, and I hope life is a little bit easier for you now. These stories just haunt you, don't they? And speaking of stories, let's tell another. Let's go to the trailer park on the south side of Milwaukee where you lived in a dilapidated trailer, where they all are, and because there is a theme of addiction addiction is so hard, isn't it, for people who are well-meaning. And Scott, who became addicted to painkillers, I believe, and had a really hard time and lost things, and then to get out of that place, to get back to where you were, is so hard. Tell us Scott's story.
So I did meet Scott in a trailer park. I think we should stress that most of the folks that in the book weren't wrestling with addiction. They didn't even drink, which was a disappointment to me because I like having a good drink after a hard day. But they weren't having
it.
They weren't having it. They judged me for drinking, and so most folks stayed away from all that. But addiction is a story in the book, and it was Scott's story. And Scott had been a nurse and had a middle-class life and hurt his back, got subscribed opiates, got hooked on them, and kind of eventually found himself with a full-blown addiction and lost his nursing license, lost his middle-class life, and ended up homeless and eventually in the trailer park. And, you know, Scott took full responsibility for his addiction. You know, he saw it as part moral failing, but also part medical, you know, biologically based. And he struggled with it and struggled to get sober. And I several times woke up before the sun was up with Scott, and I went to the county where he was trying to seek drug treatment. And, you know, would show up an hour or 2 hours before the doors open and see a line of people that were there already. And, you know, Scott doesn't ask to be excused for his decisions, but I think there is something wrong when we have people that are actively reaching for help, that want to get help, to want a medical intervention into this problem that is affecting their lives. And we just don't have enough money invested in drug treatment to give it to them, to all the people that want it. So I think that is a serious issue. We do eventually see Scott find sobriety, you know, climb out of it. And one of the reasons we see that, I think, is because he finally found access to a decent, affordable home. He got into a program called the Guest House in Milwaukee, got into stable shelter, and that was a really sturdy foothold for him on the way toward sobriety and economic mobility.
Mm, the Guest House is a good place.
Mm.
Let's go to Greg in Madison. Hi, Greg.
Yeah, I'd like to express a little bit different opinion as an 18-year landlord in Madison. You know, I understand there's a lot of sad stories out there, and that's always been the case. However, I think it's a little ridiculous to point to all these evictions and say, well, this is an ongoing problem that's very widespread, that's, you know, really the fault of the landlord. The cost of eviction is huge. No landlord in his right mind wants to go through an eviction. It's a very expensive process. It's time-consuming. It's very emotional for both the landlord and the tenant. The only reasons you would want to pursue that is if there's been something like non-payment of rent, serious damage to the property, criminal activity. These are the only reasons you can really evict anyone based on the laws today. And I don't know where your person here is getting his information. He's obviously never been a landlord, because it's obvious to me that he has no idea what it takes to be a landlord or why, in God's name, anybody would want to be one, considering how the laws are so much more in favor of the tenant than they are the landlord. I think if you were in my shoes for the last 18 years, you'd have an entirely different perspective on reality. I'm sorry for these people. I feel bad for them. But the bottom line is, if they don't pay their rent, the bank doesn't come to me and say, oh, I'm sorry, Greg, you didn't get your rent. Well, that's okay. You had a bad tenant. No, they still want their money.
Yeah. Greg, I understand your point. I'm just urging you to read Matthew's book, because there are so many levels of complexity to what he writes about that I see your point, but I really think it's important to read what he's writing about. Are you confining your examination to poor neighborhoods, to people who are paying exorbitant amounts of their salary? Is this, can you make a statement about other landlords with this? Obviously, Greg is upset with what you've written about Matthew. So what do you say to him?
You know, the book works really hard to try to capture landlords' perspectives. You know, I spent a lot of time with landlords, saw them buy property, sell properties. I saw them be very generous to some tenants. I saw them be a bit callous to other tenants. And so it's not simple, you know, and I think we let ourselves off the hook if we just say, oh, these tenants are irresponsible, or these landlords are greedy. It's much more complicated than that. Greg asked about the data, and the data are pretty darn clear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the data are very clear in Milwaukee. There are about 40 people evicted every single day. That's court record
data. Every day. 40 people every day.
Every day.
Wow.
And Greg sounds like a landlord that goes through the court process, that which is costly, and you pay to start a court-ordered eviction. You pay for the sheriff if they have to come out. But there's a lot of different kind of landlords, too. And I met landlords that would pay tenants to leave. I met a landlord that will take your door off if you're behind. We worked really hard in our survey data to capture all those informal evictions, too. And we learned that in Milwaukee, one out of two forced moves in the city of Milwaukee is an informal eviction that doesn't go through the court. These are cheap evictions, and they're efficient evictions that are also at work in our cities today.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is the author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. Matthew Desmond is our guest. The city that he writes about is Milwaukee. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John is our next caller in Ladysmith. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi.
So I'd just like to thank the author personally for bringing this to the attention of the viewers and listening audience in the state of Wisconsin, because it's a very, very big problem, and not only are people addicts, but a lot of the homeless people are veterans that have fought for this country and are put out on the streets. A lot of people have criminal records, which landlords and that do not take into consideration when they rent to a tenant, and are very, very harsh, or there's people that have evictions on their record and stuff because of some hard times that they've fallen on that landlords are negative to and will not rent to. I personally, 2.5 years ago, used to work for a nonprofit organization, and I actually worked in a homeless shelter, so I know quite a bit about the homeless problem in the state of Wisconsin, and it's not just in big cities, it's all over. Mm. It's in small town communities and everything, and that, and it, this is an issue that needs to be addressed by the entire United States.
Mm-hmm. And it begs the question, obviously, Matthew, is why hasn't it been? Why have you been the person who's really looked at this very significant issue?
I think that we have spent a lot of time figuring out the problem of joblessness, welfare reform, which was crucial to the poverty story the last 10 years, mass incarceration. You know, there's been a lot of things that have played roles in deepening inequality in the United States today. But housing has been not central to the debate because we usually focus a lot on public housing, you know, these big, giant high-rises.
Yeah.
Or we've looked through housing because we cared a lot about neighborhoods. You know, we cared about concentrated disadvantage, to speak like a sociologist, you know, how much crime there's in neighborhoods or gentrification. But here's the private housing market, consuming most of the incomes of low-income families, where most low-income families live unassisted, dictating where they live, who they live with, directly resulting in community stability or instability. We didn't know a lot about it. And so, you know, the goal of this book, one of the goals is not only to document the human cost of the lack of affordable housing in our cities, you know, how that plays out in people's lives, but also to move the problem of housing back to the center of the poverty debate. We can't fix poverty in this country without fixing housing.
Yeah. And what is the role of public housing? Milwaukee was unique. When I first moved here, I'm from Chicago, so I know about those high-rises in Chicago. When I moved here, I saw public housing, and I didn't even know it was public housing because it looks so darn presentable. Is it presentable, or is it just that there's not enough of it? How do you get into it? Is it valuable? Do we need more? Is that an answer or not?
No, absolutely. I mean, the issue is the waiting list. The issue is the waiting list. So 1 in 4 families that qualify for any kind of public housing assistance get it. Only 1 in 4.
Mm.
So, you know, and in some of our big cities like Washington, D.C., the waiting list for public housing is not counted in years. It's counted in decades. So you might be a single mom that applies for public housing in our nation's capital. You could be a grandma by the time your application comes up. You know, the folks that I spent time with in Milwaukee, you know, sometimes they'd stop by the housing authority and ask about the list, you know, the list for housing vouchers. And they'd just be told the list is frozen, you know, and on it were thousands of people that had applied, you know, years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in cities like Milwaukee, there's wonderful investments in public housing. You know, we've kind of decided to move away from these high rises that dotted the landscape of Chicago and St. Louis and Atlanta. And but the problem is there's just not enough aid to go around. We're not investing it enough. Mm-hmm. And so we have a situation where most poor renting families don't get anything, and most are paying most of what they have to rent.
Mm-hmm.
And so so I think that the issue is one of scale.
Matthew, did you know when you were going this long process of doing this, it was many years putting this together, that you were writing something that was really significant and people were going to pay attention to it, which indeed they have, which must make you feel good, even though this problem is so horrendous? Or did you think, well, there's a chance that this may go absolutely nowhere? I guess the question is, you must be somewhat heartened to know that people are paying attention to your book.
My biggest concern was wanting to write about the people that I met with justice and dignity and complexity.
Well, you did that.
And the idea was, can I get this landlord right? You know, can I really understand what it's like to be a single dad, you know, on the north side of Milwaukee, absolutely crushed by the high cost of housing? Can I write about hardships, and can I write about humor? You know, and I think that was my focus. I think that my goal was to do that, and my goal was, if I could do that and do it right, then that's something that's deeply connected to reform, that we will be stirred when we see these people and
yes.
see this problem.
Right. I think you say toward the end of the book, each one reminds you of how gracefully they refuse to be reduced to their hardships, and poverty has not prevailed against their deep humanity.
Yeah. Vanetta would say her heart. You know, she has heart.
Let's go to, thanks very much, John, for your call. Carol in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. You know, I wasn't going to call, but I just want to say that I've seen both sides of it. When I was living and working in Chicago for a little more than 20 years, I was highly paid for what I did. I worked as a technical writer. I have a master's degree. And when I forgot to pay my rent, when I had been renting from the same landlord for 7 years in Chicago, I was surprised at how swift it was. I'm sorry I forgot, but I got a five-day notice in the mail right away, you know, and I guess, you know, so I was able to just deal with that. Now, I have multiple sclerosis, and I can no longer do the work I used to do because both of my optic nerves are damaged. I've been in Green Bay now for just about 10 years, and when I fell in hard times, I had the wherewithal to look for the resources. There aren't many, by the way, for single people. If you have children, it's a lot easier to get help. I reached out to faith-based organizations, and I was always able to just get it done. Renting from someone now, from a very small management company, who's been very, very good to me. As long as I stay in touch, and I've been able to clear up the times when I was behind on rent. But people look at me, and they see that the reason that I get help is because I'm well-educated, and these pastors say, well, you know, it's no fault of your own and so forth, you know. But I get it. I so get it that people who don't have cars, don't have the wherewithal and don't know to look for help end up on the losing end. I had to call because these stories just sicken me.
Matthew.
You know, housing is a fundamental human need. You know, it's central to everything.
Yes.
You know, well, we cannot take advantage of the freedoms our country offers without a safe and stable place to live. We can't take advantage of the freedom to better ourselves, invest in our children, be active members of our community. When families finally do receive a housing voucher after years and years on the waiting list, they do one consistent thing with their freedom of income. They go and buy more food. They go to the grocery store. And their kids become less anemic and stronger. But kids like Arlene's kids, Manetta's kids, aren't getting enough to eat because the rent eats first. You know, and I think we've affirmed basic education, provision in old age, as a country, because we recognize that those things are fundamental to human flourishing and economic mobility. You know, do we think that housing is a fundamental right in this country? And I think we have to answer yes, because without it, everything else falls apart. And so, to Carol's point, we shouldn't, you know, housing is too central to be reduced to just something that cashes out. And it's too central to be reduced to, I hope I get a good landlord this time.
Yes.
You know, there are wonderful, amazingly generous landlords out there. And there's the opposite, too. But that's not the point. The point is this thing is sits at the heart of life. It's the center of life. And we can't make a dent in reducing inequality and addressing the social problems that we care about, from crime to health to education, if we're not providing safe, decent, affordable housing.
Thank you so much for your call. I'm glad you picked Milwaukee for this, too. I think it's a good city in which to do this study, because it's interesting. You said earlier that you love this place, and you know, I love this city as well, but by golly, there are parts of the city that people just sort of drive on by, and you lived to find out what was happening in those places. And, boy, you've just done something that's so important, Matthew. Thank you for it.
Thank you so much. I miss Milwaukee daily.
Well, come and visit any old time. Thanks, Matthew. Matthew Desmond, the book is Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. It's been getting all kinds of attention. He had a piece in the New York Times and the Sunday Week in Review, that's not the name of it anymore, whatever it's called. And it's an important work. He is now Associate Professor of Social Sciences at Harvard University. He is co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project, a former member of the Harvard Society of Fellows. He's a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant, which he received in 2015. He lived in a trailer park on the south side of Milwaukee and in a rooming house on the north side of the city to document the daily lives of the people who are going through the process of eviction, of trying to find housing, a fundamental thing that we all need in our lives, and it's well worth a read. And we'll be with you again tomorrow for more conversation. Thanks for listening.